Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation. Sometimes you just know when you've met the woman of your dreams. But one thing's for sure, that woman is not Tracy Richter. Just how many lives did Tracy ruin? How many lives did she take? And how did such a promising young lady turn into such a monster? This is True Crime Cast.
Welcome back to True Crime Cast. I'm Jamie, as always, here with John. Tell me something good, man.
Hey, man. Life is good. Feeling a lot better. I'm eating a lot healthier after Christmas break, so just have a lot more energy. Feel great. Really excited to be in the booth here with you tonight.
Awesome, man. Things have been going well. We're continuing to increase in downloads. We're getting more support on Patreon. We're getting more ratings and review. We encourage that to continue. I mean, there's not new stuff we need to ask for. Just keep being the awesome fans you've been.
Yeah. As we do every single week, we try not to do ads right now. No sponsors yet, but what we would really love to see happen is for you to mosey on over to our Patreon website and to sign up for a low $3 a month. You will have access to all of our bonus episodes. They are so much fun to record. I would imagine that they're a lot of fun to listen to. I mean, that might sound a little braggy there, but they're a lot of fun.
They're a lot more lighthearted than what we do on our normal shows. So if you want to see a little bit more of our personalities and a little less serious murder stuff, then that would be a good place to go to listen. We also have giveaways on there and things like that. So it is more opportunity. It's more discussion. We share messages with our Patreons or our patrons more than we do a lot of other fans. So it's a good spot to be.
It's a lot of fun. We also have some other things you can check out over there. We have coffee mugs available, which are awesome. I drink from one every morning as I'm getting ready to go to work. We also have autographed pictures of us, if that's something that you think you would enjoy. We have those available. So lots of cool things happening, lots of cool things on the horizon with possibly a store where you can order some merch without signing on to our Patreon page. I guess one more piece of homework. If you cannot join us on Patreon, a big way you can help the show is just to get on your phone and leave us a recommendation or a review on iTunes, Facebook, or what other podcast app you choose. Those are a tremendous way to help the show. We really appreciate those. And just for my perspective, and Jamie, you can chime in if you want, it's just a lot of fun to read. You know, you're going through the week, you're busy, and a fan leaves a comment, and you're like, oh, that's awesome. That makes my day better.
It does, and it gives us a way to interact. I mean, most of our messages we're able to respond to, so you're not sending it out to some mythical podcast hosts or whatever. Like, we're going to interact, and we want to talk to you. So,
yep.
We've got an interesting case today. Last week, we went full serial killer, more mainstream case. I like to come down from those kinds of things and do something that's more more localized and a little less known, and I hope we accomplish that today.
Yeah, Jamie, this is a pretty interesting case. I'm really glad that you selected this one. So you did the bulk of the research this week, so why don't you get us rolling?
Today we're going to talk about Tracy Richter. You may or may not have heard of this lady. She was born May 15th in 1966. She was known for being very attractive, John. She was a very beautiful young woman. She was also very assertive, which it seemed most of the men around her were also very attracted to that part of her personality. We're going to get more to her backstory in a little bit, but I want to jump right into the crime that took place in her home in early Iowa on December 13th of 2001. Now, this is according to Tracy's statement that on that evening, around 7 p.m., multiple intruders entered her home. They attacked her, strangling her and choking her with pantyhose. She had three children in her home that night, John, ages 11, 3, and 1, and they were hiding in an upstairs bedroom. The 11-year-old child, whose name was Bert Pittman, from her ex-husband, had claimed that a neighbor of theirs by the name of Dustin Weedy came into the room where they were hiding, looked at Bert and said, "Your mom is dead and you're next." And then he left the room.
Tracy would say that she was able to get free from the attackers and get to the gun safe, where she was able to retrieve two pistols. As she got the pistols out of the safe, Weedy attacked her from behind, and Jamie, she pointed over her shoulder and pulled the trigger. She fired 7 shots, and miraculously, she landed most of them. Now, Weedy was down, and by the time she composed herself, the other attacker had fled. After checking on the kids, she looked back in the bedroom where Weedy had been shot, and he was beginning to get up. She shot him 4 more times while screaming, "Stay down, stay down." Now, Bert was able to run downstairs. He called 911. Now, we were unable to retrieve any of the 911 footage. We try to pull those as often as we can. It's not here for this one. But needless to say, 911 officers respond very quickly to the house. They found Weedy upstairs, dead from multiple gunshot wounds. Tracy had a red mark around her neck and was claiming that she was having a hard time breathing and swallowing. And Bert, of course, was panicked and afraid.
Dustin Weedy's car was parked outside. In the passenger seat of the car, John, next to an old computer and keyboard, which had come from inside of Tracy's house, there was a journal laying there, a pink journal. In that journal, there's an entry where Weedy talks about being hired to commit a murder. He wrote that he had been contacted by the attorney of Dr. John Pittman, who was Tracy's ex-husband, and had been asked to break in and kill Tracy and Bert, who was his only child in the home. John, this is a pretty scary scene. There's evidence found in Weedy's car, eyewitness evidence from her 11-year-old son. Obviously, something had been around Tracy's neck. It seems like her statement is really supported by the evidence that we found at the crime. Yet, police don't believe Tracy, John. They don't move forward with prosecuting John Pittman or his attorney. They actually don't prosecute anybody for nearly a decade. What do we know about Pittman and his relationship with Tracy Richter?
Well, let's approach it like this. Let's just do like they did at the trial. Let's dig into her history and establish her character and a pattern of behaviors that led investigators questioning her story. How about that?
Sounds good.
All right, so Tracy met John Pittman in 1986. She was a 20-year-old looking for a career as a radiology tech. He was a 30-year-old medical student in his 4th year of his residency. Their relationship had a pretty quick start. He loved how assertive she was and even overlooked the fact that she left him an "I love you" note after their 3rd date. Now, Jamie, hold up. That's pretty crazy, right?
Yeah, that seems too early to be saying that, especially since they hadn't known each other previously, so their first date was really the first time they'd ever talked, and that to me is a big red flag generally. Not that I've had a first date in 15 years, but you get what I mean.
Right, but if you were and you had a third date, you know better than to leave a note like that.
Yes.
I would hope.
Yeah, I'm good.
All right. So he moved to Virginia to work. She went with him. They took a ski trip to his parents' condo in Vail with some of his friends and their girlfriends, and that's when the first real sign of trouble happened. Apparently, she got jealous of the time that he was spending with his friends, and at one point started screaming at some of his friends because she was being left out of some of the activities. Jamie, she even attacked a guy physically before Pittman restrained her.
Yeah, John, it wasn't good. It seems like even like the girlfriends would go on a slope that she wasn't able to do, or somebody would go out to get a drink and not invite her. She was just making up excuses to be angry. It was like she wanted to come between Pittman and his friends because she wanted him all to herself. And that's what she got when they were married on August 14th of 1988. Now, their marriage was great at first, but she quickly got bored with their sex life, and she felt like he worked too much. She got some pets because she thought that may help, but that ended up being too much work, and she wasn't really good at keeping up with the housework. And then on February 1st of 1990, she gave birth to their son, Bert. She was pretty upset when she found out that she was pregnant, but John Pittman was really excited, and eventually she came around, and she was ready to be a mother. or so she thought. That didn't last very long, as she really didn't have the patience to care for a child. Now, I know there are four kids that live in my home. It's hard to be patient sometimes, especially with babies. They can't tell you what's happening, John, but she had a very hard time. There was one night when Pittman said that Tracy woke him up because she was screaming. She was screaming, "Suck, suck." And he ran into Bert's bedroom to find her screaming at him. He was having trouble not eating as much as she thought that he needed to. And she was actually shaking him and screaming at him. He said that Tracy was trembling. She was so upset. So having a child certainly did not make her happier, and it didn't help her marriage with John Pittman either.
Jamie, we mentioned earlier that Tracy tried to come between Pittman and his friends. Well, she actually did the same thing with his family. So his parents one time received a phone call that their credit card had been stolen and a great amount of furniture had been ordered. This furniture was actually delivered to his parents' condo in Vail and immediately loaded up onto a truck and taken away. So authorities get involved as well as a private investigator, and they believed that Tracy was behind all of this. Jamie, apparently she stepped in and offered to be the one to communicate to police, which was not really part of her character. It wouldn't be like her to be this helpful. So several months later, Pittman and Tracy get their own condo in Vail. Jamie, they furnished it with furniture that looked mysteriously like those of which had been ordered previously. So his parents, authorities, thought Tracy was behind all this. However, there was no charges filed, and Pittman sided with his wife.
Yeah, it seemed that investigators thought it was her or some kind of local interior decorator, but either way, this is some, like, Ocean's 11 high stuff. Like, there's a truck that drops it off, one that immediately picks it up, and nobody saw anything. So, I don't know. She's got to be pretty smart to some degree to pull this off if she was indeed the one that did it.
Yeah, I mean, like, where is this stuff at? Where is it hidden for months while?
Right, I know. So like, where is her furniture storage illegal? Like, was it just one of those storage things where you pay $30 a month? I don't know.
Yeah.
No matter how much he gave her, or no matter what he did for her, it was like Tracy was never satisfied with John Pittman. As she complained about his work schedule, John, and again, he was going to be a doctor. You know that those are long hours. He decided to pursue a career as a plastic surgeon instead of being a general surgeon, which is what he really wanted to do. Because with a plastic surgeon, your hours are a little bit more flexible. You get to work a little bit more on your schedule. However, that was going to take him a couple of years extra school and training to become a plastic surgeon. He made a ton of money, John. Plastic surgeons make a lot. But she spent it just about as fast as he made it. She even got some plastic surgery of her own in the form of breast enhancements. There was a story of her going to Bert's daycare and just pulling her shirt up and showing all the moms at the daycare her new breasts. I couldn't find this, John, but you have to wonder if he was the one that did that procedure or if she got another plastic surgeon to do it. That's got to be awkward if she went to somebody else to get that done, right?
Yeah, I mean, this whole conversation's a little awkward at this point.
You're blushing. You are blushing. Around that same time, she had actually started working at a medical office. I mean, she had some training in that. She was going to be a radiology tech. She started having an affair with a man at her office. She actually complained to John that she was being sexually harassed at work. But she was pretty open to her friends about this affair she was having. And she actually started acting out sexually in a number of ways. John, this is very malicious. And I don't know, it starts to give you more insight into her character that we discussed earlier. But she would seek out married men. She would go out to a bar, find a guy that was married, seduce him and sleep with him. And again, like, he was complicit in this. So I'm not saying that she was the only one guilty of doing wrong here. She would sleep with him. And then when they fell asleep, she would take a picture of the man and herself while she was topless. Now, this was in the late 80s, early 90s. Cell phone pictures weren't a thing. So she would go and get that picture developed and then hook up with that guy again. So she would sleep with him a second time, and when he fell asleep, she would leave an envelope in the hotel room with a picture and a note that says, unless I get $2,500, your wife is going to see this picture. So she's extorting these men, but because of technology, she has to sleep with them on two separate occasions to get it done. And most of the time, though, John, they sent the money. So she was getting money from this. And I guess getting to her, there was some kind of self-gratification of knowing she could get these men to sleep with her and then pay her. But isn't this, I don't know, this is obviously blackmail. This is some really jacked up stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly isn't a good look by no means. I mean, one day John and Tracy would get into an argument. Now, he started to walk out the door, but before he did, he heard a gunshot. He went back inside, and there he found Tracy had tried to kill herself. Jamie, there was a bullet lodged into the ceiling. Of course, he called 911. They came and decided to leave her with John. She got some therapy, but seemed to be calm afterwards, but eventually she continued her promiscuous activity. Jamie, I think it's odd in this case that they would leave her suicidal in the home. They wouldn't take her in for any kind of involuntary hold to make sure she was okay.
It said that they brought a social worker to the house and they deemed that she was no longer suicidal. She told them that, and she would later say to authorities that he had pulled the gun on her, and eventually she got him to give it up, but she said it went off when she was trying to unload it. So I think she convinced the social workers that she may have been a victim here. And ultimately they left the choice up to John, whether he wanted to see her get admitted or not. And I don't know if he just had a soft spot for her, but he said she could stay home. And I don't know if, is that normal to give a spouse the option of whether their spouse goes in for treatment or not?
Yeah, I think nowadays they would be taken in for like a 72-hour hold where she would be evaluated and made sure she would be safe to be returned home. So just kind of odd, in my opinion, that wasn't happening back then. But anyway, Pittman would go on. He would eventually hire a private investigator. It's actually the same one that was used for the credit card fraud that she had committed earlier with the furniture we mentioned previously. And they found out that she was sleeping with many men, sometimes several men per day. Many of these guys, Jamie, were very shady characters, and the PI actually believed that there was a plot to kill Pittman. They separated. Tracy filed for divorce. Before it was final, however, she accused Pittman of molesting their son, Bert, who was only 3 years old at the time. Jamie, this is how malicious this woman is. It's actually at this point where she puts flyers under all the cars in the parking garage of the hospital where Pittman is employed, stating that he was a child molester. After a thorough investigation, he was cleared and was not charged. Pittman was able to produce proof during the divorce proceedings that she had forged his signature on life insurance documents, but he could not prove an actual attempt on his life at this point.
Once the divorce was finalized, Tracy received primary custody of Bert and continued making life difficult on John. She would often complain about his lack of compliance with her visitation agreement when it really seemed like she was the one causing the problems. In the meantime, as their divorce was wrapping up, she moved on to another man. This was a dentist named Dr. Joseph LaSpisa, who worked in Chicago. We're in around 1996 at this time, John. We also had a case several weeks ago of Bryce LaSpisa. This is actually a different last name. It's not the same, even though it sounds exactly the same. She and Dr. Joseph LaSpisa were into some interesting things sexually. He was a dentist, so he had access to a lot of drugs. They actually would use nitrous oxide to get high while they were having sex. He would allow her to administer an IV to him that actually contained drugs that would put him to sleep. So there were things happening around him that he wasn't aware of. And it wasn't too long into the relationship before she tried to extort him for $150,000. And sure enough, he didn't pay, and she followed up on her threat. She accused him of sexual assault. Now, John, the verb I've heard here is that he was later exonerated. I never found anything that he was actually convicted, so I don't know if he was convicted and then exonerated or he was just cleared of this. But before it was over, it caused him to completely lose his dental practice. So her vindictiveness, and again, this was blackmail, and a lot of times these are threats, but she obviously followed through with this accusation, and he completely lost his dental career. It was around this same time that she decided to quote-unquote clean up her act, and she met a man on a Christian dating website. Again, this is 1997. Were dating websites a thing?
I didn't know the websites were a thing in 1997. I'm from Jellico, man.
Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't have the internet in Eastern Tennessee yet.
Yeah, we were still using like Oregon Trail at that point.
Yeah. So she connected with an Australian businessman named Michael Roberts. She flew to Australia to meet him, John, in person, and 18 days after they had actually come face-to-face, they got married. They would eventually move back to the States and settle in early Iowa, where they had two kids of their own, in addition to Bert, who is still living with Tracy. Roberts was some kind of computer software salesman. There was no real clarity on what he did, and it was actually suspicious to the people around their family that they didn't know exactly what he was doing. He kind of worked from home. Tracy kind of worked with him. She tried to gain new customers, was supposedly her role in the company. And another individual that worked for Roberts from time to time, usually doing cleaning around the office, was Mona Weedy.
Yeah, Jamie, Mona Weedy was the mother of Dustin Weedy, who would later be found dead in the home of Tracy and Michael. Now, it's reported that Mona liked the Roberts, but felt like there was something kind of off about them. She did odd jobs for them, like cleaning the office, and her daughter even babysat the kids from time to time. Dustin actually spent some time with Michael Roberts and Bert playing paintball, doing stuff like that. Many believe, and I think it's important to note, that Dustin may have been on the autism spectrum. He was very good with computers, but he was not able to manage anything in his own life. At 20 years old, he still lived with his parents, and he had just been fired from a job at a local plant. Roberts liked spending time with Dustin because he enjoyed trying to share his faith with this young man, which is something that Tracy did not particularly enjoy about her husband. She felt, Jamie, that he was just too pushy with his faith. According to Mona, Tracy had contacted her about having Dustin to come over to the house just a few days before his death. Allegedly, Tracy said that she had some work for Dustin to do and that she would like to discuss it with him alone. Apparently, she said something along the lines of, he's 20 years old now, let him handle his own business.
Tracy would later say that this conversation never happened. She said that Dustin came by around 4:30 on December 13th of 2001, the date in question, and when he stopped by, he was asking her about finding work and asked if they had anything that he could do before he came back around 7 p.m. and attacked her. But it seems like a lot of what Tracy said happened that evening just really doesn't add up. First of all, she told multiple stories to police. First, it was three intruders, and then it was two. When police first arrived, apparently she kept asking them if it was her husband that she killed. She said, "Is that Michael upstairs? Did I shoot Michael? Michael's supposed to be home by now," which it seemed like everybody, including Tracy, knew that Michael was going to be gone till much later that evening. Which, I mean, Bert, her 11-year-old son, knew that it was Dustin. When police got there, he said, "Dustin Weedy's upstairs dead." And he testified that Dustin Weedy came into the room and told him that his mother was dead and that he would be next. So if Bert recognized Dustin, I mean, wouldn't she too? The red mark on the side of her neck didn't match like a strangulation mark. Police would say that it looked more like she had just taken a pair of pantyhose and rubbed them really hard on the front of her neck to make it look like a leg mark, or make it look like a strangulation mark. She would go to the hospital, and they said that she had no internal throat injuries, as if she had been strangled. Her story of the gunshots also didn't make sense. The final four shots made had come well after the initial bullets were fired. I guess going to that, John, you had some questions about those initial shots anyway. She had shot seven times over her shoulder, right? What were your questions about that?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I've said before on this show or not, but I am a gun owner. And I know that you don't make that kind of shot and land most of your shots. That is just insane and probably not possible unless the attacker is literally standing on your back and you just have to point blank shoot him. You're not going to make any kind of accurate shot pointing a gun behind your back blindly. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and he was across the room from the safe where she pulled the gun out, and she said she shot backwards over her head and shot him like 6 out of 7 times. With those final 4 shots, investigators estimated that he had been shot and killed 15 minutes before those final bullets were fired. There was coagulated blood, so clotted blood, found on the wall of the room, which means that he had been shot, his blood had had time to coagulate, and then she shot him again. They believe that she shot him 3 times in the back of the head, and then 15 minutes later went back in. He was in the same position, and she shot him again, and that's why the blood on the wall was clotted blood. Oh, and she also, despite insisting there was a second intruder, she sometimes would say, "I could identify this guy if I saw him." She refused to cooperate with authorities to do a sketch of the second person that was allegedly in her home.
Yeah, I mean, forensically, her story certainly doesn't add up, and it's not at all, I think, what it seemed to be on the surface. While there was indeed a note in Dustin's journal in his own handwriting about being hired to kill Tracy and Bert, there was absolutely no evidence of a connection between Dustin and Dr. John Pittman. So, Jamie, why on earth would Pittman contact one of Tracy's neighbors to kill her if he wanted to put out a hit? I mean, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So
I've never put out a hit on anybody. Let me be very clear on that. But I feel like if I was in that state of mind, it would have to be somebody that I really trusted that would do the job. I had to know they were professional at doing that, or I'd have to know them personally. Like, you're not going to contact somebody that's closer to the victim than they are to you and say, "Hey, could you kill this person for me?" Like, none of that adds up.
Yeah, I mean, you don't just call a neighbor and say, "Hey, I'm John Pittman. You know my wife, ex-wife, and I've got an idea." That's just, right. It's so ridiculous and outside of reality. But anyway, the next thing I wanted to discuss is actually a really big one. Police never told anyone about the journal, including Tracy. Yet 2 months later, she told a friend that police had told her Pittman was behind the attack due to a journal found in Dustin's car. She wrote several letters and emails to investigators encouraging them to look into John Pittman, even though outside the journal, she would have absolutely no reason to think that he was behind this attack. Jamie, on December 30th, 2002, she actually wrote a letter to Mona accusing her of conspiring with John Pittman to kill her. Jamie, the timing of this is awful. This came just over a month after her husband had killed himself while he was visiting his son's grave. Jamie, she is a horrible, horrible person.
Yeah, obviously we started this episode out making it set up as if her story... Well, we told you her story first. She's a monster. I mean, this was almost the year anniversary of Mona's son being killed. A month earlier, her husband had gone to Dustin's grave and shot himself in the chest at his grave to kill himself. So she's lost these two people in their lives. And then Tracy is going to accuse her of having a role in this entire setup. In April of 2004, Michael Roberts filed for divorce from Tracy. At that point, she told investigators that Roberts had confessed to plotting alongside Pittman in the home invasion. So she's now accusing her ex-husband of conspiring with her current husband of killing her for insurance money. Now, the best part of this alleged confession is that she said that her husband, Michael Roberts, often talked to her in his sleep, and she could ask him questions, and he would offer up things without thinking. Last week we discussed whether truth serum was real, and she expressed this in a way as if when Michael Roberts was sleeping, he had some kind of truth serum, and he confessed to her in his sleep that he had a role in this plot to kill her and had sent Dustin Weedy to the house to get that done. Now, keep in mind, throughout all of this, the district attorney of Sac County, Iowa, said there was not enough evidence to prosecute Tracy for Dustin's murder. I realize we know what happens at the end, and hindsight's 20/20 and all that. How could he be in a position to say that there's not enough evidence to move forward? Is there something I'm missing here?
No, man. I mean, from where I'm sitting, I think there's plenty of evidence.
And she couldn't keep her mouth shut, John. She continued communicating with investigators, attorneys, the district court office about the case all the way up until July of 2011 when she was arrested for this crime. She sent so many letters and so many emails, and she would continue to say things that would incriminate herself. She referenced the journal that she should not have known existed. She accused everyone in her life, aside from her family members, of being involved in this conspiracy. At one point, she talked about Michael Roberts sharing premonitions from God about how John Pittman would ultimately be brought down from this. So she's saying outrageous things, and she's saying so much that it really gets her in trouble. She never stopped digging her own hole. In 2002, John, less than a year after this happens, she went on the Montel Williams show. I know you're a big Montel fan. As the face of a courageous mother that took a life to save her own children, she really owned this persona of the tough mom that saved her kids and saved her own life. But her assertive nature and her desire to control everything that happened in her life ultimately did her in. In 2010, there was a newly elected prosecutor in Sac County. As far as I can tell, John, Sac is not short for anything. It's SAC County in Iowa. Ben Smith was the guy elected. During his campaign, one promise that he made was that he would look more into Dustin Wheaty's murder. That he did. He charged Tracy Richter with first-degree murder of Dustin Wheaty. The Wheaty family also filed a civil suit, but they didn't have the finances to follow through with it. And unfortunately, they had to drop that suit against Richter.
Yeah, in the criminal proceedings, the defense, of course, went with the theory of self-defense. Their star witness was that of her own son, Bert, who is now 20 years old at the time of this trial. He was very sure that he saw his mother being attacked and testified to that. But members of the jury would later say that everything he said sounded way too coached to really be believable. In November of 2011, just a few weeks after testimony, Tracy was found guilty of the 2001 murder of Dustin Wheaty in an attempt to frame her ex-husband. The next month, she was sentenced to life in prison. Now, Jamie, her son Bert continues to fight for her. He raises funds for appeals, and he talks to media as often as possible. Her case at the appellate court was shot down by a unanimous vote. She continues to be a menace even from prison, which honestly, after hearing all this about her, doesn't really surprise me. Apparently, just a month after her sentencing, she emailed an inmate with Michael Roberts' name, social security number, and address. Roberts has also reported that he continuously gets threats from Tracy's family, who adamantly support her, and Jamie, he essentially has to live on the run.
John, Tracy has family that are in law enforcement. Her mom has her back. I'll get into that here in a minute. But apparently they threaten him, and when they find out where he lives, they go there to threaten him. So he really feels like his life is in danger continuously. Later in 2012, there was a judge in Iowa, John, that ordered that she still had rights and that Roberts would have to bring them to the prison regularly for visits. At the time that this was ordered, he was living in California. John, he's actually served two separate 30-day stints in jail for contempt of court for not taking his kids to Iowa to see his ex-wife in jail. Because he's living life on the run. He doesn't want her to know where he lives. Is this a normal thing? Like, I know you work in social work where people's legal rights to their children are determined. She's been convicted of first-degree murder. Are her rights at all in jeopardy there?
Well, I mean, what I don't have in front of me is I don't have documentation showing that her parental rights were removed. So if they have not been removed, then she would still have legal right to see her children, even though she's incarcerated. I know that's not a popular answer, but that's the reality of the law. It would not be difficult, in my opinion, to have her parental rights terminated so that they no longer have to do the visitations or anything.
Yeah. So he served jail time for not following through with this, and he continues to live on the run to this day. Speaking of her family, I mentioned her mom. In 2014, Tracy's mom, Anna, had her home raided by police and had her computer seized. It contained evidence that she had been harassing and threatening the state's witnesses in this case online. She had apparently publicly accused several of the men who testified of child molestation, which is apparently a go-to false accusation for this whole family. However, Anna was never prosecuted for this online harassment. In March of 2017, Tracy's final appeal for post-conviction relief was denied. The three-judge panel said that there was no merit to her allegations, that the trial was unfair, and that there was, quote, overwhelming evidence of Richter's guilt. So, I mean, that's kind of the story here. Do you buy the prosecution's theory that Tracy set this whole thing up just to frame her ex-husband, that she committed a murder just to get her ex-husband in trouble and to remove him from her life so she would have whatever she wanted from him? I guess sole custody of Bert, and he gets in jail for the rest of his life. Do you think she did that?
Man, I really tried to objectively look at this case. There's a lot of things that just don't add up to this story. The journal, I mean, goodness, the list could be very long, but there's a couple of things that I take away that lead me to believe that this case is open and shut and that they've done the right thing here. Forensically, when you look at her neck, you know, she said that she is strangled with a pair of pantyhose. But because of what I do, I have kids who go see forensic doctors who, that is all they do. They look at damages to your body and they can determine what caused that. And they know that, you know, if you put a pair of pantyhose around your neck and strangle somebody with it, it's going to look much different than her wound, which was very superficial and was only at the front of her neck. Forensically doesn't add up, so I don't buy that. Another thing I don't see is, why in the world would Dustin have any motive? Now, I know a few weeks ago we spoke with Kristen that we need to look at forensic and evidence and not look at motive, but, you know, I still kind of look at motive a little bit, and Dustin didn't have any motive to harm Tracy or her child in reality, so I don't know, man.
Any chance this was self-defense?
No, I don't think so.
Even assuming let's assume there could have been a motive.
Forensically, it just doesn't add up.
I completely agree. I see no way that her version is true. The prosecution's version makes sense. They estimated that either she made him write the journal entry at gunpoint, because it was in his handwriting, the journal entry about him being contacted by John Pittman's attorney to commit this crime. That was in his handwriting. So they estimate that she either did that at gunpoint or she used her sexuality to coax that out of him, to get him to do that. I think both of those things are well within her nature. And also, if you're going to do that, why would you write a journal about it?
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly see either one of those two things being a possibility given her character. Even outside of this case, I mean, we know that she was doing some shady things with guys. And so, yeah, I could definitely see one of those two things being a possibility.
So how's a monster like this created? You referenced earlier that that the private investigator thought that John's life may be in danger. What that investigator saw, John, was that Tracy was on the phone across town with her husband, John Pittman, who was her husband at the time. She called him and said that she was at home waiting for him. Now, what the private investigator had seen just a few minutes earlier was a group of men that she had been sleeping with entering the home. And again, you mentioned that those were shady characters. They were also violent characters. So what the private investigator saw was a group of men waiting in John's apartment for him to come home from work. So if she's willing to do that to kill her husband, and again, that's private investigators seem to be at least that's their profession, right? So he wasn't completely off base with the types of people with which she was associating. And then we see her using Dustin's life as a pawn. Like, she ended that young man's life to get back at her ex-husband. She lashed out at Mona, who had just lost her son, and then her husband. Like, she makes people's lives awful. How does that happen?
Jamie, I don't know that I have a good answer for you, but she does not think about anyone other than herself and what she wants. I mean, you look at what she did to just Mona's family. Mona lost everything, her son, her husband, her peace of mind. I mean, look at all these guys that she got money out of for sleeping with them, taking pictures, and then blackmailing them to give her money. I mean, this woman is sick, and there's definitely a diagnosis out there for her. I'm not trained enough to give it to her, but, man, she is definitely certifiably crazy.
We don't have as much information about her childhood as we do, like, a lot of the serial killers that we cover, because those individuals are studied a bit more. But we do know that she has siblings that appear to be living, and I hate the word normal, but regular lives. They go to a job. They have a family that is unified. They function in society without being involved in these things. Her mother continues to support her. Her siblings continues to support her. So it seemed like there was love in that family. So you just have to wonder, like, what switch flipped for her, and when did it flip, and what different causes there were behind it. And I don't have the answers to any of that, but she, like, we talk about serial killers killing people. She's just mean. I'm not saying it's not, these serial killers are not doing awful things as well, but she just seeks out to ruin people's lives. And it's very personal, I guess, is the problem. Serial killers often kill people because they like killing. She is very personal in her vengeance and her hatefulness. And that's, it just feels different.
Yeah, she is a... not a woman I would want to run into, certainly not a woman I would want in any part of my life, because it seems like if she's there, she's like the lion crouching at your door, you know? She's a snake. So, yeah, I'm glad I did not know her personally, and hopefully I don't ever know anyone like her.
When I pitched this to you, I think I said, because you had just finished up the Dirty John podcast series, she's like a Dirty Jane. Like, she is ruining the lives of multiple men, trying to get money from them, trying to extort them and things like that. So she reminds me in some ways of Dirty John.
I don't know if you have in mind a name for this episode, but I think Dirty Tracy would be a good one.
She is dirty. She's filthy.
So, Jamie, thanks for doing this case, man. It was a little more lighthearted than our last case, which was some heavy serial killer information, that of Edmund Kemper. Thank you for bringing it to our attention. Please don't forget to check us out on Patreon. It really makes our day when we see interaction on there and more people signing up. And the more folks we have sign up, the more awesome stuff we're going to do. I think we have several ideas we can toss around with each other that we just need more help from you all to do. So continue to sign up for that. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter. Shoot us an email, truecrimecast@gmail.com.
Like John said earlier, rating, reviewing our podcast is probably the best thing you can do for us. That helps us climb the iTunes charts and get more visibility. If you don't have iTunes, you can rate us on Facebook. There are some ways to do that on Stitcher if that's how you access the podcast as well. Just tell your friends. Share our episodes on social media. And let us know what you think. Let us know how we can improve. We're always seeking to do that too.
Yep. Guys, until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media.